the show where we share our favorite stories from Boston history. This is episode 60, Holidays on the Harbor. Hi, I'm Jake. Nikki and I are taking the week off from researching and writing a new episode. We'll be spending the holiday weekend with family out of town, but that doesn't mean our hearts won't be back in Boston. If you've been listening to the show for a while, you'll know that we have a soft spot for the Boston Harbor Islands. From the many podcasts we've done on them to our annual camping trip on the islands, it's one of our favorite local destinations. This week, we're going to share three stories from the Harbor Islands, all of which are from the earliest days of our podcast, within the first 20 episodes. We'll hear about the zoo shipwreck, a hermit who made her home on the harbor, and the secret Harbor Island base where Nazis were smuggled into this country after World War II. Just about this time last year, we first aired episode 9, which was titled The Zoo Shipwreck. It was all about the wreck of the freighter City of Salisbury in the Outer Harbor in 1938. Unlike most shipwreck stories, this one has a mostly happy ending. Let's settle in and see how it goes. But now it's time to take a look at some more modern Boston history as we examine the wreck of the City of Salisbury. Boston was an important port city for most of its history. We're relatively close to European ports, with a sheltered deepwater harbor. At the same time, it's a fairly treacherous port. The Harbor Islands do a great job of sheltering the inner harbor, but they also make the outer harbor hard to navigate. Though a deep channel has been dredged in modern times, President's Road and Nantasket Road were, for most of our history, the only navigable shipping channels, and they're both very narrow as they wind in between the islands.
Because the treacherous channels are so hard to navigate, there are multiple lighthouses in Boston Harbor. Boston Light, on Little Brewster Island, is the most famous of all. It was America's first lighthouse and is now the oldest operational light station in the U.S. It was first built in 1716, so, amazingly, it celebrated its tercentennial this year. We went out to visit it in June, and you can during the summer months as well.
Yeah, and expect to hear more shows about the history of Boston Light in the future.
The other very distinctive lighthouse that's still visible in Boston Harbor is Graves Light. Built on a rock outcropping far out in the outer harbor, Graves Light is the tallest and outermost lighthouse in the harbor. And if you're cruising through Boston Harbor, look carefully at Long Island Head. There's a lighthouse barely visible through the trees, just uphill from Fort Strong, which we referenced in episode 5. Those lighthouses still remain, but when our story takes place, there were also lighthouses on Spectacle Island, Deer Island, Lovell's Island, and in the channel near George's Island as well. And in the days before GPS, these lighthouses helped guide ships into Boston Harbor.
Ships like the City of Salisbury, which is a 415-foot steam-powered freighter that displaced almost 6,000 tons.
That's a pretty big ship, right?
By the standards of the time, yes. But it's a fraction of the size of a modern container ship. I was curious about that, so I looked up how big a modern freighter would be. And it turns out that there are different standard sizes for different waterways around the world. The Panamax standard defines what ships can use the Panama Canal, which maxes out at 950 feet long and about 60,000 tons. And that's not even the largest standard.
So that's about twice as long and 10 times as heavy as the City of Salisbury.
Yes, but again, we're comparing it to other ships of its time. It was a pretty good-sized steamer. And we're not just talking about steamers here. Sailing ships happily coexisted with steam for decades. There are pictures of Boston Harbor full of both sailing vessels and steamboats well into the 20th century. I've even seen a 1935 photo of the harbor, where there are plenty of four-masted schooners tied up at the docks right next to steamboats. I'll see if I can dig that photo up for the show notes. But by that time, sail was far past its peak, still in some use. If you have the ship, you might as well sail it, and you wouldn't even have to pay for coal. Now, by the time the City of Salisbury arrived in Boston Harbor on April 22, 1938, it had traveled almost around the world. It was a British flag vessel, and it had traveled to India and Sri Lanka, and it loaded a cargo of jute, rubber, iron, tea, sugar, rice, silk, and tapestries. Then, from the Indian Ocean, it had traveled all the way to the east coast of North America, making a stop in Halifax before coming down to Boston.
You know, what makes the story interesting isn't the rubber or the silk, it's the animals that were aboard. One of the most valuable cargoes the ship carried was a load of exotic tropical animals destined for U.S. zoos. There were 40 pythons and 40 cobras, one of which ate its mate while at sea. Most records say he, but I have to imagine that that was a lady cobra. And 20 crates of exotic birds. And there was a Himalayan bear that got loose and wreaked havoc in Calcutta. And some 300 monkeys. And while they were docked in Halifax, about 24 monkeys got loose and rioted in the streets. We've featured a lot of Boston riots on the show so far, but this was a little different.
Yeah, I loved that idea of a monkey riot. So while we were getting ready to record this episode, I did some Googling, and I discovered that monkeys actually did riot in New Delhi, India in 2007. They actually killed a politician who was trying to fight them off. So, to fight the out-of-control monkeys, the authorities brought in bigger, scarier monkeys. We'll link to a brief BBC article about the New Delhi monkey riot in the show notes for this week's episode.
Now, you just have to imagine how perplexed the citizens of Halifax must have been while this was happening.
So you can imagine that after such a long, eventful voyage, Captain William H. Lewis was looking forward to the end of his journey. He must have looked at Graveslight off his bow with a certain sense of relief. As they approached the outer harbor, the weather was clear, but as the ship then maneuvered northeast of Graveslight, a fog bank moved in and reduced visibility. Boston Harbor has 34 islands, sandbars, and narrow channels. Even today, navigating in the tight quarters of the harbor in the fog can be nerve-wracking. But Captain Lewis had every reason to be confident. His map, Government Chart number 246, said that there was 33 feet of water under his keel. So imagine his surprise when, with a terrible groan, the ship came to a sudden and complete stop. They were stuck on a previously uncharted rock outcropping, a kind of spire or pinnacle of rock sticking straight up from the seafloor.
Now, Captain Lewis might have preferred not to make history by discovering new land on this voyage.
But he didn't have a choice. Though there were some questions about that, and in fact an investigation later, he was eventually cleared of any wrongdoing, and Government Chart number 246 was found to be faulty. Now, in the hours immediately after the wreck, all the animals and most of the crew were taken off the ship in local vessels. 14 sailors and 4 officers remained on board to help with recovery efforts. The problem is that a ship is meant to be cradled and supported by the water it floats in, but now the Salisbury was only supported by a small ledge of rock. As the tide receded around the ship the next morning, it started to groan, and the hull buckled under its own weight. The men aboard hurried aft, and then the ship broke in half just ahead of the smokestacks. The forward half rolled over and sank quickly out of sight. The stern shifted around, sending a scare through the men who remained on board, but then settled back onto the rock. We'll have pictures of the ship as it was stranded on the rocks and at the moment it broke in half in this week's show notes.
As the ship broke up, the skeleton crew was taken off by a Boston tug that had ventured near the uncharted ledge to bring them to shore. Efforts to recover the valuable cargo continued throughout the summer. Including both the animals and the other goods on board, the cargo was worth almost $2 million. In 1938 dollars, which makes it the richest cargo ever wrecked in Boston Harbor. The stern was precariously perched on the ledge, but still somehow managed to survive the hurricane of September 1938, one of the most powerful hurricanes to ever hit New England. It was finally a nor'easter the following month that did the city of Salisbury in. The high winds drove the stern off the rocks, and it finally slipped beneath the waves. A photographer captured that moment when it slipped out of sight, and we'll have that photograph in the show notes as well. While the bow section was under 80 feet of water, the stern section was still almost at the surface. Over the next few months, divers blew up parts of the stern with dynamite to clear the navigation hazard, and sections that could be brought up were sold as scrap.
Between the storms and the dynamite, the city of Salisbury today is little more than an underwater scrap heap. However, that doesn't stop it from being a popular destination with local scuba divers. In fact, one group discovered and recovered the city of Salisbury's anchor in 1995, bringing it ashore in Salem and restoring it for display. We'll have a photo taken by divers at the wreck of the city of Salisbury in 2014 in the show notes for this week's episode. Graveslight still stands as the outermost sentinel in Boston Harbor, but it's also taken on a new life. The government put it up for auction in 2013, and a local couple bought it. While it still shines its beacon to ships at sea, it's also being renovated as a weekend getaway for the new owners. They've been keeping a blog of their unique home makeover project, and we'll post a link to that in the show notes as well.
Hopefully, if we promote their blog, they'll invite us over for drinks this summer.
Fun! In March of this year, we aired an episode about two hermits from the history of Boston who found ways to isolate themselves from society in different eras and different areas. One was an eccentric hunter who hid out in the forests of Hyde Park, but the other was a reclusive widow who lived on an abandoned schooner on Boston Harbor from the late 1920s right up until World War II. Our story of the Boston Harbor Hermit was originally part of Episode 19.
A woman named Anne Windsor Sherwin tried to find her solitude on Boston Harbor. Anne Windsor was born in Michigan in 1882, and at some point she moved to New York. In 1910, she married the playwright and actor Lewis Sherwin, who was then working as the drama critic for the New York Times. They lived in Manhattan, and all seemed well at first, as they had three children together. Hollywood came calling for Lewis in 1914, and he made it pretty clear that Hollywood hadn't mentioned his wife and children. He abandoned the family, and he moved out to the Los Angeles area. Lewis became a scenarist, which is what we'd call a screenwriter today, for Samuel Golden Pictures, which would become part of MGM in later years. He has 7 writing credits on IMDb, and will include some promotional materials for his debut 1919 silent film, Bonds of Love, in this week's show notes. It seems to have opened to tepid reviews. Variety said, "Bonds of Love is at the Strand this week, and proved to be an acceptable and simple narrative of love for a man and child, set in the surroundings of a millionaire. What stories this Sherwin could write, if he would, those who remember his clever, often brilliant contributions to local criticism can imagine. But let him start slowly. He has devised a story that any first-class exhibitor can buy with profit, particularly if he wants high-class patronage."
In the meantime, Anne and the children attempted to make their way on Long Island. Anne sold some short stories and worked as an interior decorator, but the money was far from sufficient. By 1922, the family was living in an abandoned mill building in Oyster Bay. They were broke, and the children were chronically absent from school. When Lewis publicly announced his engagement to a young starlet, it brought media and law enforcement attention to Anne and her family. They were forced to flee Nassau County to avoid prosecution, and they wound up in Boston. Sometime between 1927 and 1930, Anne and her youngest child, William, took up housekeeping on the hulk of a 4-masted schooner called the Snettend that was moored in Federal Wharf in Boston Harbor. The Snettend had been built in Seattle in 1919 and was quickly refitted to ship coal and lumber up and down the East Coast.
Can we just take a minute to reflect on how weird it is that 4-masted schooners were still not only being used in the teens and 20s, but were still being manufactured? Tall ships seem like a relic in the age of armored battleships, but I guess they still served a very practical purpose.
Yes, though the Snettend was actually the last wooden schooner to be outfitted in Bath, Maine. She performed her duties until one ill-fated voyage in 1927. She was headed from Norfolk, Virginia to Bangor, Maine with a shipment of coal. Soon after leaving port, she was caught in a strong storm and had to be towed back to port to repair her masts and rigging. After 6 weeks of repair, she got underway again, but as she rounded Provincetown on the Cape, a bigger problem came to light. The load of coal in the Snettend's hold was on fire. 2 tugs and a Navy ship finally got the fire under control, but the Snettend had to be towed into Boston Harbor.
By early 1928, it was clear that repairs were a lost cause, and the ship was left to languish at a pier in East Boston. The record is a bit unclear as to whether the ship's owners invited Anne and William to move into the Snettend as night watchmen, or whether they simply squatted on her, as they had squatted in the Nassau County Mill Building. No matter how they came to be there, in 1936 the owners of the ship decided they wanted the Sherwins gone. They had decided to scuttle the ship, that is, to tow her to the outer harbor and deliberately sink her. They issued an eviction notice, which Anne and William defiantly refused to accept. In the show notes this week, we'll have a photo from news photographer Leslie Jones, snapped in January 1936, and captioned, "Anne Windsor and son William refused to leave the Hulk Snettend after eviction notice." The owners of the Snettend were thwarted by the Sherwins' refusal to leave, but they were also pretty sick of paying rent on that berth in East Boston. They decided to turn over title of the 245-foot-long ship to Anne Windsor Sherwin, but in doing so, they also towed the ship to a permanent mooring just off Castle Island. Despite this victory, the family's luck went south almost immediately. In a storm that winter, the Snettend was torn from its mooring and swept out to sea. Luckily, it ran hard aground on the shore of Spectacle Island.
Amazingly, Anne and William continued to live aboard the Snettend even after it was wrecked on Spectacle Island. A newspaper report described their littered living quarters and said that the Boston Police Department termed their situation indescribably unhealthy. They grew a garden on the deck of the ship and were treated as a curiosity by other vessels coming in and out of the harbor. The last chapter of the family's hermitage was written as World War II broke out and young William was drafted in 1943. Without her son, Anne Windsor Sherwin was unable to manage the solitary life on Boston Harbor. She had to move ashore, and the records last place her in Virginia in the early 1950s. The Snettend caught on fire in 1947 on the beach at Spectacle Island and burned pretty much to the waterline. In July 1951, she took her last voyage. Without sails, masts, or rigging, the Hulk was towed out to the outer harbor by a single tug. The story of the Sherwins was well known, and curious onlookers watched from the beaches and pleasure craft. While the burned-out Hulk didn't look like much, some onlookers noted the patch of flowers from Anne's garden that was still visible on deck. On July 21, 1951, the Snettend was sunk in 190 feet of water. Today, the hull sits upright and intact, and it's a popular scuba diving destination.
Going way back to the beginning, we talked about a secret U.S. military installation on Long Island in Boston Harbor in Episode 5. As World War II wound down in Europe, the United States and the Soviet Union desperately vied to capture top Nazi scientists who could help advance our space and nuclear weapons programs. Here in the United States, many of those scientists made their entry into the country through the secret base at Long Island's Fort Strong, which itself was left over from an earlier era in coastal defense. This episode originally aired on November 27th of last year. This week, we're stepping into a little-known chapter of Boston's 20th century history, but the story starts in war-torn Europe.
The Allies were stunned by the technological and scientific advances made by Hitler's Germany. Everything from jet airplanes to stealth technology to nuclear weapons made huge advances under the Reich. Some of the most terrifying inventions of the war years were the V-1 and V-2 missiles. The V-1 Buzz Bomb was an early cruise missile, while the V-2 was a ballistic missile. It could be launched from Germany into space before crashing into London to explode. The V-2 was the forefather of both the space program and the Cold War, and the father of the V-2 was a scientist named Wernher von Braun.
Von Braun was the wunderkind of German rocketry. He'd been obsessed with the possibility of spaceflight since he was a teen, and he got his doctorate by the age of 22. By the time he was 25 years old, he was a member of the Nazi Party and successfully launching liquid-fueled rockets.
His enthusiasm for space came with a seeming disregard for the people killed by his rockets and missiles, inspiring the Tom Lehrer lyrics,
"Once the rockets are up, who cares where they come down? That's not my department, says Wernher von Braun."
In the spring of 1945, the Soviet Red Army had pushed within 100 miles of von Braun's base in Germany. With the Nazi regime rapidly collapsing around him, he began to look for a suitable end to his war. And while the fighting was ongoing, U.S. and Russian teams were racing around Germany, attempting to capture technological resources and valuable personnel. Like many Germans, von Braun thought he'd be treated more leniently by the Americans, so he needed to find his way to American lines.
And one account says that he used falsified papers to steal a train.
No matter how he did it, about 500 members of his team made it from the Baltic Sea coast in the extreme northeast of today's Germany to the Bavarian Alps. There, SS officers had orders to kill any scientists who might be captured by the enemy in order to safeguard their secrets. Nonetheless, the team slipped across the border into Austria and into American hands.
Having evaded the SS and the Soviets, and having been approved by the U.S. military, von Braun was moved around Germany and interrogated at secret bases. Then, he was handed over to a secret army unit called Operation Paperclip to be taken into the U.S. And like many top Nazi scientists, his entry point was right here in Boston. To understand why Boston was an attractive option for the military intelligence operatives who brought these German scientists into the U.S., we have to step back in time. Before the Second World War, before the Great War, and even before the Civil War. During the heyday of naval power, it was important for a port city like Boston to be protected by a network of forts. So starting in the 1830s, a ring of three stone forts was built in the Boston Harbor Islands.
Fort Warren on George's Island is probably the best preserved, and it can be visited by ferry in the summer months.
A few decades later, modern concrete forts were added on several more harbor islands. These were cutting edge during the World War I era, but their importance was dwindling by the beginning of World War II.
In the age of aircraft carriers and submarines, shore-based artillery was just less of an effective deterrent.
Most of the forts still had at least some military presence. Some were used as bases for submarine nets or spotters, while Fort Andrews on Peddix Island was used to house prisoners of war. So when it comes time to bring these captured scientists into the States, Boston has large Army and Navy bases, a modern port, air bases like the one at Squantum Point, as well as this network of isolated harbor islands under military control.
German scientists could come in by air or by sea, but in either case, the last leg was by Boston Whaler across the harbor.
And this is an area where David Boeri's article is priceless. He was able to interview one of the Army intelligence officers involved in Project Paperclip in the brief window between the project being declassified and the officer's death in 2010.
In 1945, Henry Kolm was a 21-year-old Austrian Jewish immigrant who had been on the last refugee ship to make it out of Europe in 1939, and many of his close friends and relatives died in the camps. Kolm had recently joined the U.S. Army, and because he was fluent in German, one of his first assignments was interrogating Nazi POWs. But at the end of the war, he had a different assignment. When troop ships would come into Boston Harbor bearing one of the project's Nazi scientists, Kolm's team would rendezvous with the ship in the outer harbor before harbor pilots met the vessel. In the dead of night, often in heaving seas, the crew would lower the scientist off the deck of a towering ship to the small boat far below, in the lee of Nix's mate.
When the German scientists came ashore at Long Island's Fort Strong, they found a world that might have reminded them of their universities or labs back in Germany. An old hotel on Long Island had been converted into a luxurious barracks for them, and it was staffed by their fellow countrymen. To help keep the island secret, military intelligence had combed through POW camps around New England and pulled out prisoners to serve as cooks, bakers, tailors, and stewards.
No need to worry about chatty civilians if your whole hotel staff is made up of prisoners.
Exactly. And within this gilded cage, the engineers and scientists created a scholarly atmosphere. Holding lectures and exchanging ideas, it became comfortable enough that the island was jokingly referred to as the House of German Science.
That's Haus der Deutschen Wissenschaft.
While the scientists enjoyed Boston's hospitality, Henry Kolm and his colleagues were busy assigning them to post-war projects and cleaning up their war records to make them more appealing to America.
Depending on their areas of expertise, the scientists and engineers from Fort Strong ended up at military bases and defense contractors all over the country. Many engineers and physicists went to Oak Ridge National Laboratory or Los Alamos to work on the Manhattan Project. Rocket scientists were sent to Aberdeen Proving Grounds in Maryland or White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico. Von Braun himself ended up at Fort Bliss in Texas. The U.S. Army falsified documents to hide his background, and he was granted a security clearance to work on highly classified projects.
Because a former Nazi obviously wouldn't be granted security clearance otherwise, so this is an incident where we see, you know, this secret unit in the Army really pulling the wool over the eyes of the rest of the Army and the entire defense industry and really America at large.
Eventually, Von Braun would become a familiar figure to Americans. He was a very public and enthusiastic spokesperson for the space program, appearing in newspapers and popular magazines, as well as eventually on television through a partnership with Walt Disney. He advised Presidents Kennedy and Johnson, as well as NASA and the Apollo astronauts. However, he remains an incredibly controversial figure. Because the Army had whitewashed his background, many Americans didn't realize his deep ties to the Nazi regime until much later. Von Braun would explain this away as a politically expedient way to keep working on his beloved rockets, but he not only joined the Nazi Party, he joined the SS. He eventually reached the rank of Sturmbannführer, and he was knighted by Hitler himself.
And not only that, his V-2 rocket factory had used slave labor from the concentration camps, so he really couldn't claim ignorance.
Again, he tried to minimize his involvement, saying at times that he wasn't aware of the worst aspects or that he felt powerless to stop it. However, other witnesses say that he personally picked laborers from the camps and that at times he had ordered prisoners to be whipped. A survivor of the camp said, quote, "On a little area beside the clinic shack, you could see piles of prisoners every day who had not survived the workload and had been tortured to death by the vindictive guards. But Professor Werner von Braun just walked past them, so close that he almost touched the bodies." That satirical song written by Tom Lehrer in 1965 mocked von Braun's claims to be an apolitical scientist, calling America's attention to his complicity in the Nazi regime.
"A man whose allegiance is ruled by expedience, call him a Nazi, he won't even frown. Nazi schmatzi," says Werner von Braun.
Von Braun retired from NASA in 1972 and died in 1977, having realized his dream of putting men on the moon.
Fort Strong was decommissioned after the war, and the island passed back into civilian use. However, that doesn't mean it has been open to the public. Long Island was used for social services both before and after the war years. The city almshouse was moved to the island in the 1880s, followed by hospitals and other city institutions. In the 1950s, a bridge and causeway were built that connected Long Island to the mainland. More and more public and nonprofit social service agencies moved to Long Island over the years, until it became the city's main site for homeless shelters and substance abuse treatment by the 1980s. In many ways, it was the perfect location for these agencies, as there were no neighbors to be annoyed or frightened. And, unfortunately, the bridge was condemned in 2014, and the island was abruptly evacuated. Today, the bridge has been demolished, the island is abandoned, and it's still closed to the public.
But I've been there. I was excited to learn recently that I'm one of a very few members of the public to have visited Boston's Long Island. When Op Sail brought a festival of tall ships to Boston Harbor in 1980, the island was briefly opened to residents of Quincy so they could watch the ships come in. I was about 18 months old at the time, and my mother put me in the basket on her bicycle, and we rode across the causeway and bridge to watch the ships come in. I feel like I'm part of a special group. All right, that's it, folks. To learn more about any of this week's stories, check out the show notes at hubhistory.com/060. We'll have links, pictures, and sources for all the stories we covered in this week's episode. If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're Hub History on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. While you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode. If you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, please consider writing us a brief review. It's still the best way to help others discover the show.
That's all for now. We'll be back next time to talk about an important event in Boston history that's celebrating its 150th anniversary next week.